for a beautiful spring day. The cherry blossoms are looking nicely. Today is a committee meeting, March 24th. We'll start out with the Finance and Budget Committee, Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I kind of walked in here late, I apologize. Let me get to my material. Here it is. We have five action items today. I think they're on the revised agenda that was sent out by Julia. The first item is acceptance of the NCAA agreed upon procedures report for the year ended June 30, 2016. So I'm going to note that we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We have all of the members of the committee present, so we certainly have a quorum. And in order to initiate a conversation and discussion on this, I'll ask for a motion for approval of FB1. Motion by Barbara and seconded by David?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm sure there's some discussion and questions, so open the floor to the committee and then to the rest of the board. Hearing no discussions or questions, Andy?
Brad Shelley, Senior Manager from Kroll Horworth, is here to address your first two agenda items, the NCAA report and the audits for radio and TV. So I'll turn it over for a short presentation to him. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Amy.
Before we go, if we could just do FB1 first and then
sure.
Two. Okay.
All right. Thank you. Glad to be here and glad to present this to you. Should have the agreed upon procedures in front of you. I'll just walk through this quickly. I don't want to go through it in great detail, but if you do have questions, obviously, feel free to ask those. So on page one of the report is our independent accountant's report. So this is our report in here. This is just simply stating that we're not doing an examination, we're not doing an audit. These are just agreed upon procedures. These are procedures that the NCAA requires, so these aren't even something that we have came up with or the university. These are NCAA required procedures looking at the revenues and expenses related to the athletic department. On the next page, page two, is the summary of revenues. As you can see by the different sports. On page three is the summary of expenses. And I won't go through these line by line, but those are there for your view. On page four are the notes to those statements, just a little bit of additional information to go along with that. And then starting on page five are the actual procedures, and the procedures are split into two categories, revenue procedures and expense procedures. Again, as you flip through this, there's several pages of it, so I don't plan to walk through each one. The quick summary version is there are no exceptions noted during the procedures of our testing the revenue. As you look through here on page 5, section 4, there are several bullet points here. These aren't findings. One of the procedures is to obtain analysis and information on large increases year over year or large decreases. So those explanations are listed here. Those are not considered exceptions. On page 6, you'll see some minor differences at the top on number 5 between the ticket reports and the statements. All four of these differences are very immaterial amounts. Those are common to have immaterial differences like that. So, again, nothing to be concerned about there. As you continue through the report, the rest of the revenue procedures, there were no exceptions noted during that testing. The expense procedures start on page 11 and continue on through page 16. Sorry, page 17 and on to page 18. No exceptions, again, noted on any of the expense procedures. So no issues there to report. And then on page 19 and page 20, are the year-over-year variances. So this gives you the comparison of fiscal year 2016 versus the prior year, fiscal year 2015. Just noting those variances. And then, again, these variances that are large enough, that are off to the side, there are explanations for those in the actual report. So if you have questions on those are included in there.
The indirect institutional support variance.
Yes.
It's 10.6% and direct is 32.8%. Those are pretty big changes.
Yeah, so the, again, I'll direct you to page 5 that shows the explanations for each of those. The indirect is in relation to a variety of factors. It's outlined there. So it actually decreased due to calculations related to utility and labor costs. That's a lot of information. The direct institutional support is really the piece that is what I would say, for lack of a better term, is the plug. So that's how much support the university is providing to balance the budget. That actually did go down as well. And so if you look at some of the other variances that went up on revenue, such as line 13, conference distributions, that increased. So because you got more distributions in from the conference, from being a full member of the Conference USA and from the bowl game, you increased revenue there, which required less university distributions.
Combined athletics is, the last few years has been hit both ways, not only institutional budget cuts, but a dramatic decrease in funding as students paying athletic fees have reduced, given the enrollment fluctuation. So they've lost about $4 million over the last five years. So the institution support is in significant decline.
I think that one of the questions you were asking in the note, there had been an historical practice of using estimated utilities that would show up in indirect institutional. When the calculation was done to really validate, apparently we had been overstating that component of the report.
So this roughly $900,000 decrease is the result of having overestimated or putting an escalator in indirect costs? It's just such a big number.
Randy, is there more than one component than the utilities that brought that number down?
Also the debt for Dental Arena and so forth.
I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
The debt that we pay for the Dental Arena and so forth is down as well. But primarily, as Ann said, the answer is correct. And historically, there was an escalator used on the utilities. And once we looked at the utility actual cost compared to the escalated estimated cost, there was a big difference. And that was the biggest factor in why the decrease of the number.
It's just such a huge proportion of the budget, almost a 20%. Decrease, and it's just hard to
understand. Dr. Birch, the other thing is that the way the NCAA requires this report to be completed might be a little different than what you would expect from a budget perspective. So we don't bill athletics for utilities. We don't bill anyone for utilities. So it's a prorated cost that the NCAA requires to be shown as an indirect support to athletics. So, you know, that's just a different variable when you start thinking about revenue and expenses for athletics. That's just a variable that is in this report but is not in the way we operate financially. But we're comfortable now through this process that we have a mechanism to use actual rather than a formula to try to estimate what it is. So that had been done for quite a few years, and that's the correction.
And I think you, as President Ransdell was mentioning, you kind of need to look at that together, the institutional support together as one piece. So line 4, the direct institutional support, and line 6, indirect institutional support. That's the total support that's coming from the university. So there's positive aspects of the decrease, which is the that you had more outside money coming in from conference distributions. So that was a positive, almost $1.7 million. That in turn means that university has to kick in less money to support athletics. So that part of it is actually a positive piece. The piece that President Ransdell was mentioning, there are some also negative factors in play there that create some changes. But so it's a combination of the two is really how that would be best looked at.
One other question on page 20. Mm-hmm. When you talk about support staff, administrative salaries, benefits paid by university and related entities.
What line?
And then
22.
I'm sorry?
What line?
22.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's 24, line 24. And then above it are compensation benefits paid by a third party. Who are the related entities, given that the third party is different?
Line 23.
Non-university funds included.
Paid by a third party. Would the third party be HAF? Third party would be
HAF is included.
HAF.
In this account. That is correct.
And the terminology on and related entities is a standard format for NCAA reporting.
I understand. I just didn't understand what it means.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think I'd like
John?
To play off this outside funding. You know, we can talk about eras, but let's also focus on positives. And first of all, the conference, by again, decisions that were made some years ago, was 121%. I'll take that any day as an additional revenue. And number two, the good job that our development office as well as athletics contributions are up almost 40%. So those two things, again, to combat changes in expenses, that's where we've got to look. And that is has been a strategic plan over a period of time. That doesn't happen just overnight. So I think that we need to look at that as well as an effort of all those involved are trying to do their very best to support athletics in an outside way rather than using university funds. So I applaud those individuals. I couldn't name one of them right now and would be afraid to do that and leave somebody out, but we do need to recognize that. That's huge.
Any other members of the committee? Any other questions, Director? Anybody else? Any questions or comments? Anything else, Ann, on this? Well, hearing no further questions or debate, motion's on the floor. It's been seconded, so I'll call for a vote. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 And opposed? FB1 has been approved. And again, to spur debate, I think procedurally, and I'll refer to Dr. Capps, I have to have a motion on FB2, which is acceptance of the WKYU-TV and WKYU-FM radio audits for the year ended June 30, 2006.
So moved.
John Regent Ridley's
second.
Motion. Second by David Porter. And FB2, you want
to? Okay. Again, I'll turn to Brad and let him brief the board on it.
Thank you. And I failed to mention to thank Randall McGee for the help throughout the process on the NCAA procedures. On the TV and radio, we work with David Brinkley and Emily England, and so thank them for their efforts throughout the process. We'll walk through the TV financial statements. Is that the first one you have on your...
We have both on, but it's TV, whichever.
TV, okay. We'll go with TV first. Whatever's first for you all. So, so we'll go through these reports. Last year, you probably noticed these got a little bit thicker with the GASB 68 reporting requirements related to the pensions. Fortunately, we didn't have anything new that we had to add this year, so it's still thick, but we didn't add any thickness this year. On pages 1 and 2 is our independent auditor's report. This is our report to you, and we are providing an unqualified opinion, which is the highest quality opinion we can provide, so there's no material misstatements in here. You do see the emphasis of matter on page 2. That's simply stating that this is only presenting the station, and these are not part of the university financial statements. So that's just a clarification there. Pages 3 through 7 are what we call the management's discussion analysis. This just gives the highlight of the financial statements and gives some analysis from management on what some of the fluctuations were. On page 8 is the statements of net position or your balance sheet. I won't go through this in great detail, but when you look at year over year, fairly consistent. You see a slight decrease in total assets and deferred outflows and resources. This is primarily due to depreciation of your capital assets, so not a lot of changes here. And then on the liability side, liabilities, again, are exceeding the assets due to that net pension liability from last year. So just a reminder, that is something that all of the governmental agencies were having to record, including the university, and so that is what is causing that negative net position.
I want to clarify one thing. On that portion of the allocation of the pension, that's a non-cash flow item?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. There is a cash flow piece to it, which is the contributions into the plan.
Right.
But this amount here that you see as a liability, that's a long-term liability that will be funded years down the road, so it's being funded over time.
So as that pension problem is solved in the coming years, that number should theoretically go down.
That number should go down in theory. Now, how they solve that is another.
I understand.
Can we go back to page 3? At the bottom, you were talking about depreciation. Is that the reason for this net position going from $2.2 million and that appears to be 2014. Is that the way that reads? Down to 641, back up to 681. Was that because of depreciation?
Where are you seeing that exactly? Are you seeing that
page 3, it says net position. The net position of the station was, and then there's a set of figures, and then at June. So it appeared that there was a huge decrease between 14 and 15.
I think he's just meaning the note.
Well, the huge change between 14 and 15 was related to the GASB 68, the pension adjustment that was made.
Ah, okay.
So that's why you saw a decrease there.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Yours or what explains the significant change in the Corporation for Public Broadcasting? Is that a...
So you're on to page 9 now? Is that...
No, somewhere in there, yeah.
Okay. Yes. Okay, so that was a combination of... I think there was less production, as you see up above in the revenue and expense side. On the, for example, the expenses, programming production was down from $1.3 million to $1 million. So there was less activity there, so there was less need for grant dollars coming in from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So that's because all of that grant funding is cost reimbursement basis, so that means you have to spend the money to get the money. Picking up on page 9, that's really the main change that you'll see throughout here is the reflected in less revenue under production. You'll see in less expenses under, again, programming and production. So your operating loss, which is there about in the middle of the page, is a negative $2.4 million. That's actually less than last year. And that's the way these types of organizations are designed. So then you have your net out or your non-operating revenues that pay for that losses. So those are your appropriation from the university, other grants, other, you know, indirect types of support. So that's all categorized in the non-operating revenues. So your change in net position is there towards the bottom is a negative $126,000. And that's about what you would normally see. You'll see those close to break even. That's what we'd expect. Page 10 is the statement of cash flows. This is really just walking through the change in cash. There wasn't a large change in cash. You did have an increase of about $97,000. So this is just walking through that change. At a high level, if you look at the three different categories, you spend a lot of cash on operating activities, then you get a lot of cash in through non-capital financing, which is that non-operating money. So you're spending it, but you're getting it through another source of revenue. Page 11 starts the notes to the financial statements. There were no new accounting policies this year that really had any effect on the TV financial statements, so you'll see no real changes through here. I won't walk through each of the notes because, again, there were no significant changes, but if anyone has specific questions, I'll be glad to answer those. Starting on page 18 and really continuing through most of the rest of the report is the pension plan report. Again, as a reminder, that's what was new last year. Those are required disclosures that are in there. That is just a portion of the university's requirements there. And then on pages 28 and 29 are the required supplementary information. Again, this is related to the pension plan. So this is the share of liability and the other balances and information related to the station. Anyone have any questions on the TV? Okay.
So those on the pension report, those seem to have stayed rather consistent as a percentage of the overall payroll.
Yes. And I would expect that to be the case going forward, unless the station were to have dramatic changes in the number of employees and
up or down.
Right. Yeah.
Any other questions on the TV? Anybody? Okay. You want to go on to the radio?
Yep. So the next report you should have is the radio financial statements. Again, on pages 1 and 2 is our independent auditor report. Similar to the TV, we have an unqualified opinion. This looks very similar to what you saw in the TV reports. Again, on pages 3 through 7, we have the management's discussion analysis with the variances there and some explanations. I would say, again, pretty similar to what you would see when you're looking at the TV financial statements. No significant changes there. There are no new accounting policies. On page 8 is the statement of net position. Again, this is what we call the balance sheet. So you have a slight increase of assets and deferred outflows of resources this year, primarily on the cash side. So you do see an increase of cash of about $200,000. As you look at the liabilities, slight increase on the liability side, mostly related to those net pension liabilities again. And then your net position is a positive $681,000 at the end of the year. On page 9 is the statement of revenues, expenses, and changes in net position, or your income statement. Pretty consistent year over year. So as you look through here, your operating revenues are fairly consistent there. This year you had less in the in-kind contributions there. Just in relation to other indirect services that were provided. And then on the operating expenses side, fairly consistent, about $1.9 million. Again, so you have an operating loss of about $1.8 million, and then you have non-operating revenues, again, of appropriations from university grants, those things of that nature. Takes you to a change in net position of a positive $39,000. So right at around break even. Page 10 is the statement of cash flows, and again, similar to the TV, you're going to see the outflows of cash on the operating side, and then inflows of cash through the non-capital financing activities. Those are, again, your non-operating revenues coming through. And starting on page 11 are the notes to the financial statements. Again, note 1 and note 2 are going through accounting policies, and there were no new accounting policies. The rest of the notes look very similar to the prior year and also to the radio. Primarily, you see the pension plan note in here. So that's included. And then on pages 27 and 28 are the required supplementary information for, again, the proportionate share of the pension plan related to the radio station. Any questions on the radio station? I failed to mention also I brought my colleague Michael Lavender back in the corner. He's senior staff on the audits and he does most of the actual work, so I want to make sure I included him and acknowledged him. So,
well, I apologize. I was on my question earlier was on I was reading the radio, but you were talking about TV.
Okay, well, I couldn't find that number.
I thought, why didn't he even understand? So, if you don't mind, could I go back to that question now that we're on radio? Mr. Chairman, you could have said get on the right page.
So let's try again.
Let's try my question once again. I think it's the same answer, but I'm not sure.
On what page?
3.
Okay, good.
Bottom.
Okay.
Net position.
Net position.
Yes.
It wasn't net position at the bottom of the other one. We were real thrown. Okay.
Yes, that's what I understand. Net position in this case,
$2 million to $641.
Once again, was $2.2 million in 2014, dropping to $641, then back up to $681 in thousands. But
Can you give us the same explanation? It was the implementation of GASB 68 and having to record that net pension liability.
Right.
That pension liability was recorded last year. And so that was why you booked this large liability that decreased your net position.
Right.
And yeah, so that.
So your answer was the same.
Same explanation. I thought I knew where you're going with it.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Thank you.
No problem.
I just noticed the comparison of both. And yep. Thank you.
You're welcome.
John, did that answer the right question?
Yes, it did.
For the right station?
Yes, the right station.
That's the end of your remarks,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's it.
David Brinkley is over there. He oversees both operations. We'll give David just a minute or two to add anything you want to add about programmatic for over the last 2 years.
Sure. We appreciate, as always, the university's tremendous level of support for both television and radio. We have several positive aspects moving forward. We have provided you with our local content and service report for your review. Convenience later. We have several projects ongoing. Worthy of note, we just had an engineer 2 days ago named to a national project with PBS, one of the 25 in the country. That we're participating in tons of programs like that, we are able to sustain our operations. Again, when we look at the main financial changes, those are due to 3 factors, the GASB 68 implementation, foundation endowment losses, and the square footage reassessment tied to all 3 of those factors. All of those aside, our university support has been critical. President Ransdale and I and Robin Taylor have been in Washington to try and work on the federal aspect of the funding for corporation public broadcasting. We've also talked to individual members, Leader McConnell, Congressman Rogers, Congressman Guthrie, Congressman Homer, and certainly Senator Paul in person several times to make sure that the federal funding is intact for corporation public broadcasting. Personally, I feel positive about the results and think that the university support at the level that it is, it helps make the case for us on the federal side. If there's anything any of you want to do personally, to contact your individual members of Congress, feel free to do that on our behalf.
I'll get into the federal budget discussion later in the executive committee. So, David, you might stick around for that conversation on our executive committee agenda as well. I'll get into federal budget briefing based on the proposed federal budget about a week ago.
Will you also address how the position that our representatives in Washington are taking in relationship to that?
Sure.
Good.
Any questions?
I would point out once again this accounting change in Gadsby, it should not be let go, because now it happened in 14 and now we're saying to 17. That number, that rolling 3-year number, is going to roll off, and we're not going to see that. And when that isn't glaring in your face, that liability has taken away from our net asset. And that's huge. Think about your own personal situation. If some accountant walks up to you and say, well, yeah, one time you had a net worth of this, and because of an accounting change, you now are a lot less, we'd all be quite concerned personally. Mm-hmm. And that's going to roll off as far as a glaring indication, and that the reason to get that solved is pretty serious. And it causes us to look worse than we really are.
Yeah. That's the main thing. I mean, our actual assets with which we work are stable and...
Exactly.
I'll stop short of saying sufficient.
Yeah.
But they're stable. So this does give an awkward indication of the net asset value.
Couldn't agree more with that, John. Anybody else? Anybody? Question? No questions or other comments, then I'll ask for a vote on FB action item number 2. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, like sign. That motion carries unanimously. All right. The next one, again, I'm going to follow procedure, and I think it's correct to ask for a motion for the acceptance of the second quarter statement of revenue and expenditures, which is on page 3 and 4 of the material that was previously given to everyone. If I could have a moved by Regent Birch, second.
Second.
Second by Regent Ridley. And.
This is the second quarter statement, obviously, through December 31st, and we're in March. But due to the timing of our committee meetings, we're almost finished third quarter, but we're not finished, so we can only report on the past two. So the data indicate in the agenda item that on a percentage basis compared to budget, we were tracking pretty close to what you would have expected this time compared to the previous year. The difference would be in tuition, which we will address in the reallocation plan. And as we indicated in the budgetary implications and have announced that while this is only through December, looking at February and March, we know that the likelihood is a $6.5 million tuition shortfall, and that'll be addressed under our presentation on the reallocation plan. Other than that, there aren't any variances that need to be noted.
Any committee members have questions?
What's in the other, and do we expect that to be quite a bit over budget for the rest of the year?
In the other category. Mm-hmm. You said, what you got is some variances as when revenue comes in or gets some volatility. In the other, it's very typical that it's tied to to specific programs, and they know to underexpend if the revenue's not there, or if they are really successful, we'll come back and ask for a budget increase for them. So it's usually not a concern in that category because it's very program specific. An example, it would be like the university farm. You can imagine what type of, they have milk sales, I believe, and crop sales and whatever they have. So there's some variances on those things, but the University Farm monitors their only their revenue and will adjust their expenditures accordingly.
John?
Well, and you're not, it won't surprise you, I'm always, you know, we're talking about December numbers, and now here we are almost into April, and it's very difficult to forecast, and you've got lots of entities and a budget at the size of almost approaching $500 million. However, it would be going forward my suggestion that we do everything, whether it give your staff additional funding to be able to get these numbers to us early as possible. And I know you give a very, very good effort in trying to do that, but in your narrative, or whoever did the narrative, in the second sentence, it says actual tuition and fees compared to the same time last year have increased by 2% in comparison to an increase of 5% on comparable budgets. That would make one think that we're doing pretty well. Our sales are up 2%, but yet we budgeted for 5%. Is that the assumption that I'm hearing?
What that is saying is obviously this board approved a tuition rate increase.
Not necessarily.
That's
not my question.
The tuition rate increase is reflected in an increase in the comparable budgets. So the budgets went up 5%. We knew we were budgeting for a tuition rate increase. However, when you compare the revenue collected as of the end of December, it was only up 2%, while you had expected it to have been up 5% because your budget went up 5%. So while if you compare actual revenue to actual revenue, we have more revenue. But we should have more revenue because this board approved a tuition rate increase that was built into the budget, causing that item to be increased by 5%. Did I make it better or worse?
Can I piggyback on it and ask a question?
Provided John's been out, you can go.
Well,
back.
I'll let Barbara speak. My question's been answered, but I'm going to ask Ann again.
Okay. Go ahead. I just want to ask it another way, too.
Basically. Yeah, please.
So are you saying that the actual amount is up 2%, but we projected it to be up 5%?
Yes.
Therefore, in other words, our plan for spending was based on 5%, therefore we're 3% short.
Yes.
All right, that was my question. Thank you very much. That was my question. I understand about us approving a tuition increase. That wasn't the question. But I guess what, in simple terms, we need to under-promise and over-deliver. And if we're running budgets with a trend of decreasing enrollment, we can't just decide that a revenue increase, we've got to tie it to the enrollment side. Can't be just we approved a 5% tuition increase and based it on historical numbers. So it would be my suggestion going forward that we try very hard to budget in a cushion rather than just what the tuition increase was. Because the net number is we don't have enough money to provide for the operating budget. And if we're forecasting high revenue and our expenses are known, that we can. But the revenue stream is what is a mystery. So my suggestion is, in that case, last year we would have budgeted expenditures on a 3-4% with a cushion of 1-2, and we wouldn't necessarily be at a 6.5 million possibly. We would be addressing maybe half that. So I think we are a little aggressive in assuming our revenue would be where it was. That's what my point is.
Yeah, that's very valid points. We have historically looked at the previous fall's data and have been optimistic that we could maintain that same level of enrollment. At the same time, when we built the current year budget, we did reallocate $6 million to have a balanced budget. So it's a bit of a crystal ball. I reflect back probably to one of the first budgets I saw for WKU, and the tuition estimate was not done by the vice president for finance directly or the budget director. It was done by the accounting director. So you can imagine how conservative that was. And but you know, his track record was pretty good on a very much lower base. He usually ended up with about $3 million in surplus until people kind of got angry about, why are you lowballing this all the time? We have so many needs on the expenditure side. So it's a science and an art that allows us to try to look at. We look at data, applications, acceptances, yields, anecdotal cohorts that people know about. But we have obviously not had some of those numbers come to fruition this year. So that's why we're 4% overall. We're 4% short in that which accrues centrally for Fallen Spring.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Barbara. Sorry. No, you go ahead.
You commented on revenue-dependent programs. But I seem to remember a year ago where our auxiliaries were down. Where are we on that right now in this? I mean, I could see where the collections are, but is that projection up or down?
Let's see. We're tracking very closely to last year's on auxiliaries, but I believe by year end we're going to have seen an improvement in the WKU store. Which is significant in that. Yeah, I'm feeling that we're under new leadership, and I think we're starting to see the results.
Anybody else? One thing I want to piggyback on something John said in the conversations you and I've had, trying to address his question about timeliness of putting these numbers out for consideration. You're working right now toward presenting a proposed budget a lot earlier than we generally see it. Am I correct about that? In the normal course of maybe April?
We plan to discuss the fiscal year 2018 budget at the April board meeting, but we're still on schedule for approval of the budget in June.
Oh, yeah, we're not taking it off that particular schedule,
no.
but we're going to be getting some of
the earlier. We'll have a specific discussion on the 2018 budget at the April board meeting. We're not prepared today.
It's difficult, and I've had this discussion. I mean, it's very difficult when you've got as many entities to try to, and as many moving parts, if I may, and to get it earlier. But every effort, and if it was a budget that a half a person extra in her staff, or should we realign how we gather the data, whatever that is, that would increase the ability to help forecast some of these things. I just think you were working. Mm-hmm. You know, we got data from December. Now here we are talking about doing a budget for 17, 18. And
we have been historically presenting you with quarterly revenue and expenditure statements. We could change that to the most recent month. I could, instead of December, I could have brought you February. If you would feel more comfortable with that change, it's just kind of an accountant's perspective to say quarterly.
Quarters, I understand.
We could present February. We're just obviously still in March.
Well, what we're trying to do is to prevent trends that are being created, and we're getting the data later. And that's I would not change your accounting procedures. But, and this isn't a business, but in business, you want to try to forecast what you think is going to happen next, not wait till the bad news comes and then say, oh, what are we going to do? So it is a difficult issue, and I recognize that. But
thank you.
Anything else? No further comment, then I will call for a vote on the pending motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Hearing no opposition, the motion carries unanimously. Next item are personnel actions that appear beginning on page 4. And, of course, attached to that are both the faculty report and the staff report. They run pages F1 through 29 for the faculty and S1 through S23 of the staff. Again, keeping in procedure, I'll ask for a motion for approval of the personnel actions.
Second.
And second by motion by Barbara and second by David. Ann?
Your agenda item gives you the dates for personnel actions for permanent increases and the one-time compensation. Let me note that I inadvertently left something out of the description that's of substance that you probably saw, but let me clarify. On page F-16, what you don't always see in your personnel actions is an important action by this board. Page F-16 is faculty promotions and tenure list. So not only are you approving when you approve the personnel actions of the salary adjustments, you are also approving the proposed faculty promotion and tenure list as the salaries. I don't believe you're approving tenure. I'd have to find Provost Lee, but you're approving the salary recommendations associated with those personnel actions.
There does seem to be tenure. At least one tenure on here. Several. I'm sorry.
So there's a column that says proposed rate and salary. That means that you are in fact approving those dollar amounts as you approve the personnel actions. Where's
promotion.
Oh, that's right, promotion and tenure. But by approving, what I'm asking technically, by approving this agenda item, are they in fact approving your recommendation for tenure and promotion?
And they are sending it to the full board for approval. But
right.
Yes, they are endorsing that recommendation.
Okay. So the question is, there seems to be 22 promotion and tenure, at least tenures in there. Am I reading that correctly? It seemed to be 22 tenure
on page F-16
and 17. Yep. Yeah,
right. So you're approving promotion and tenure when you approve this agenda item.
Okay. Well then,
but you'll have that report coming up in the academic committee.
This is just on the personnel side. It's not part of the academic affairs.
Okay. And that's why I wanted to clarify that, in fact, your action is not just approving the salary, you're in fact approving the promotion and tenure as well as a personnel action.
But that process has been through the academic process.
Yes.
Department head, dean, provost, to me, and all these are approved.
Yes.
Yes. These are ones that have gone totally through the process and goes through by everybody who needs to touch it.
I think we just changed our methodology. We're just including it in the personnel action section.
Okay. The pages F-16 and 17 contain this information. We're part of the package. I think I should ask Barbara and David, who made the motion second, did your motion include that as well? Okay.
Yes.
I'm not sure.
Sorry for the confusion I'm creating by that. That's an important component that's different than your normal personnel actions, and I wanted to make sure that there was recognition that you are taking that action.
And these reports are very thorough. You know, we started putting everything in these reports a year or so ago, but you know, on F-18 through 18 and 19, 20, we've got faculty overload payments. When the faculty are asked to do an additional course, or students do an additional course, we get overload payments. We've got a long list of supplemental pay for faculty. That's in addition to their base salaries, and there are several pages of those. I mean, you have a very thorough, you got lists of the winter teaching pay. Pages, so you have a lot of we have everything that involves compensation for faculty and staff. Every individual who receives salary compensation considerations in every possible category are on these lists. So this is a very thorough compensation report, and it's one of the difficult things is, you know, we talk about $6.5 million shortfall to balance the budget, which I talked a moment about how that's being addressed. And sometimes it's difficult for some to understand, well, how can somebody get an increase? Well, it's a large, complex institution. We have a lot of faculty by procedure get overload pay and get supplemental pay and have consulting, and winter term, summer term. So there are a lot of variables that come into play, and that's all factored into the total budget profile. And it's sometimes pretty simplistic to think that, well, if we're having this budget problem, how can so-and-so get a salary increase? Well, because they've earned it, because they've taken on additional courses, or they're doing things that are required by our academic procedures to earn additional money. It's our HR staff and our staff in academic affairs do a superb job of ensuring that proper university procedures followed in the compensation of faculty and staff.
I agree, it's very thorough, and I think it is a compliment to all those who are making it this thorough. I think it does raise one thing. It's not so much a question, just a thought for, I guess, administration more than anything else. I understand all the reasons for them, but I think one of the campus-wide challenges we have is to help people understand how do you get on this list of 52 pages. There are all kinds of, I mean, there's equity, there's adjustment because of a market, there's a dozen different reasons. And for people that aren't on the list, it's a lack of understanding of what do you have to do to get a market adjustment if you think you should get a market adjustment. So I think on the plus side, it's great that we have all the details. On the flip side, in a big system, it leaves a lot of confusion, uncertainty, and frustration with the idea of how do I get considered for a market adjustment, merit increase, or whatever it is. And I think somehow, if there could be more discussion of that, and I don't know what you do about it, but I think it's an issue.
Communication.
That's it.
Yeah. And it's a fundamental outcome of a very decentralized budget. So we empower division heads, administrative council to make those decisions necessary to effectively meet their programmatic requirements. And you know, every single one we could probably have an explanation of a key employee that was offered a position somewhere else and we really didn't want to lose them, or what you don't see in the personnel actions is a note that says that a position was eliminated and the work was reallocated. You know, it's a long report now, but the thing is that there's someone held accountable for each one of these recommendations.
I want to kind of follow up on what Dr. Birch said as far as on the staff side as well, though. There is a definite perception that, and I can't fault any of these, and I'm glad these departments figured out how to do market equity and how they could get these kinds of raises for people that I'm sure are very deserving. But I do know that there are a lot of, especially on the lower end of the salary scale, there are a lot of people, a lot of staff who've taken on additional duties who never receive any kind of compensation. And, you know, if there's some way to figure out how to communicate with areas but if a department doesn't have the money, they still continue to ask people to do more without receiving that adequate compensation. And that's a feeling across campus.
John?
My gosh, we've covered a lot of territory on this. First of all, it's just an opinion, my opinion, that if we as a board do want to have shared governance, and we have addressed that in all of the various things we've discussed, at one point the danger in getting into this lower end, and I don't mean this from an informational standpoint, I see that as a department, an administrative role, and the board are not responsible for communicating to individuals. So we need to set the policy of how we get that good information to people and then let that process work. So that would say that's an area for our improvement would be for the policy. Second thing that I've recognized that we've covered in this conversation, we cannot forget, regardless of how deserving all these people are and those that are not getting raises, we've got to realize that every time we approve something like this, that increases our fixed costs. When we improve salaries, increases our fixed costs. Well, then at the same time that we're giving salaries, we've got to figure out where the revenue is going to come to do it. So that is something we have to constantly be conscious of, and that is the responsibility of the board. Recommendations come to us, and we make the approval. But when we do that, next year, when people say, well, why are you going to have to increase tuition? Well, the reason is we've increased our fixed cost, and salaries are part of the fixed cost. So I want us to be sensitive to what we need.
I'd like
but at the
to
same
just
time,
do a slight technical clarification to your
please,
point.
Please, help me.
Divisions are required to reallocate in order to fund these increases. So it's the base budget. It doesn't come back as a new increase. But to your point, let's say that there is a retirement system rate increase. Then obviously with a higher base salary comes a higher contribution to the retirement systems. So it is both. But the responsibility of a division head is basically to only under very few exceptions do we not say that it's to be funded by reallocation within division. Sometimes we have an exception in a small division that's warranted. Small divisions don't have the capacity of the larger divisions, but majority of these changes on here are all done with existing base budget. But you're right, moving forward, whenever you increase your salary base, if you hire new positions, which are in here, the base salary is funded by the division, but any adjustments moving forward obviously are become fixed costs.
I agree, but I was just trying to get the big picture instead of the small. When you increase your fixed cost, you're going to have to fight the revenue. And with that, I would say, what's the solution? Then it would have to be, in a business, gross cures all. More sales allows you to do more things. More students, more tuition is going to allow us to give more salaries. So we can make the solution, but the charge is how do we solve the revenue side? It'll take care of the expense side. And that is a responsibility of not just the parents that pay it. It's the faculty to retain them. It's the effort of the alumni to help promote. But gross, I always call it GCA. Gross will cure all. More revenue, we can do anything we want. So that's the comment. As we raise salaries, we got to figure out where it's coming from. And that's my big picture point.
Don't lose sight of the fact that the policies we set affect those things.
Exactly.
Retention.
Exactly.
We talk about that a lot, but there's more than just the faculty we have. It's the advising we have. It's many of the policies we put in place. So.
Thank you, Philip.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I'm not disagreeing with what I've heard. I want to clarify something I said because I think I might have been a little unfair when I said 52 pages, which we have. A lot of this 52 pages, it consists of just changes in positions, lateral transfers, reappointments, other kinds of things. So that was kind of an unfair statement. But I also want to add, based on what John said, I didn't mean to suggest that there wasn't management, proper management at department level. I think one of our strengths is the fact that we let people make those decisions closest to where they're responsible for what has to happen. I would hope we don't change that. I think what we're touching on also is a bigger picture, and my point was that when people see so many pieces like this, it just raises that question of overall that it's just addressing the frustration level of individuals. What do you do to get compensation to the level we'd all like to get it? And you can only spend the same dollar on time, whether it's going to go to compensation or something else. So that ultimately is a board direction.
Well, you know, Barbara, I've always been a proponent of what you've said in the compensation area. But John, or I think John is absolutely correct as well. I think what happens here is that there's far more complexities in these numbers, and far more you just can't look at one and draw a conclusion. You have to look at the overall picture, and that's sometimes difficult to do. Anything else? Any other questions? I'm sorry.
Call for the question.
No. Getting ready to do that, John. All in favor of FB4, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, like sign. Motion carries. FB5, which was referred to earlier by Ann, is the fiscal year 17 budget reallocation plan. which appears on page 6. So we'll be asking for an approval of that reallocation plan. Again, in keeping with the procedure, I will ask for a motion for approval of FY17 budget reallocation plan.
So moved.
David Porter.
I'll second.
And seconded by Julie Henson. Ann?
Okay. As I indicated just a few minutes ago, the projected shortfall as it relates to fall and spring tuition revenue, which accrues centrally, is approximately $6.5 million. This estimate will not address any variances in summer, winter, online run through the Division of Extended Learning and Outreach. Their estimates are considered revenue dependent. The proposed plan essentially is to identify one-time funds that we can use for a balanced budget for the end of the fiscal year. Our process was to identify any central funds that we could apply to the projected shortfall. The second step is we went to the division heads and said, we have alerted you since last November or December to be careful in allocating your carry forward in anticipation of an enrollment shortfall and the tuition shortfall that results. Excuse me. So divisions had been somewhat careful in allocating their carry forward for emergency items only. And then the last step was after we determined how much divisions had been holding back for a potential shortfall, did we come up with $6.5 million? And no, we did not. So we had a second process that said we will go back for the amount that we need still to cover the $6.5 and prorate it among divisions based on their year-end carry-forward balances that resulted from fiscal year 2016. In the middle of your agenda item, it summarizes how you get to those three components. The amount that was considered central funding in the first place is in fact funds that were held in reserve but attributed to DLO, I think it was 2008, that when our reserve was considered too low, DLO in fact allocated $1 million for the benefit of the university. Dr. Birch reminds me it was a loan. I just didn't, after it's been there since 2008 or 2009, I inadvertently forgot how it got there, but I do know that there's been $1 million held that had been identified as DLO and held in the university's reserve. We had approximately $714,000 that resulted from the final one-time savings when we outsourced the health clinic on campus. We kept that in a reserve to allow some evaluation of the outsourcing of that operation just in case some reason we might have to change our mind and bring it back in-house, or a big unknown, what if you had a pandemic and you had to vaccinate everyone, of which we would absorb the cost, but we probably didn't know maybe how much that would cost. So it seemed like a good idea at the time to say, let's not make any hasty decisions on this $714,000, so we've had that in a reserve and are willing to say that this would be acceptable practice to give up that reserve. We've got some funds left over in that relates to scholarships and some bonds refinancing. On the scholarship savings, the institutional scholarship budget is approximately $24 million. So to have approximately $500,000 is not a significant variance on a $24 million budget. If you think that I use a crystal ball for projecting tuition revenue, I can tell you that the Office of Student Financial Systems is highly more technically sufficient than that in determining the number of freshmen that will accept our scholarships and the number of returning students that will be here the next year to use their scholarships. So, again, it's another complex model trying to project human behavior, student behavior, and it's better. If you look back over the last few years, it is much better to come to you to tell you that we underspent than I think the year that we came to you and told you we overspent. So at this time, we're approximately 2% off of that budget. So the correlation is, if you didn't award the scholarships, the students aren't here, and that's why you have a tuition shortfall. So it's a logic to be able to tie those two together. Mm. So to the degree that in that institutional scholarships budget, there are some summer school expenses related to certain populations that reciprocity students that come on a state agreement that it extends to them in summer school. So I don't have all the final numbers. And when we do have the final numbers, we'll obviously adjust this reallocation plan up or down as to small variances as to how much more we may or how much less we take of the division's carry forward. So this plan has approximately $4 million of division carry forward to cover the 6.5. Out of that $4 million, approximately two-thirds of it was identified by the divisions as balances that they were holding in anticipation that they'd have to give it up. So that helped tremendously to be able to bring this forward for a balanced $6.5 million, knowing that that they had not fully obligated their carry forward. I do have some information from the divisions. I'll tell you, I got it this morning. It occurred to me that we probably ought to have some examples of potential impact of not having these funds, and it's in categories pretty much that you would expect. And as Dr. Birch mentions, it's not uncommon when you don't have the carry forward. Academic affairs indicates that it'll impact professional development for faculty and staff, operating support, instructional equipment. Those are the items when we talk about we're 60-70% personnel in our budget. When you've got to make any reductions, you normally make it in the operating side and in the equipment side. There's some facilities that perhaps the major maintenance or deferred maintenance will be pushed off for another year. In facilities, whatever we have left over typically goes into the high voltage electrical repair. When you get your 6-year capital plan, you'll see I unfortunately have a warped sense of humor and I joke around about that. I said that's phase 9, 10, 11, and 12, I think. But that's the truth about an infrastructure like this. We use one-time money to keep doing pieces and parts of a large infrastructure to make repairs to keep the campus open. So, there's a possibility that the loss in carry forward can impact building systems and our ability to respond to some emergencies. It will be pretty common across the campus that there'll be delays in computer purchases and other equipment purchases. I think that's probably all I can add about this agenda item, and I'll answer any questions.
Right.
Actually, you've given me some information in your presentation that I wasn't aware of, and maybe it's clarification, not so much that we're $6.5 million in a shortfall, but you mentioned, and correct me if I'm wrong, you said that of the mandated waivers, fellowships, bonds, refinance, and other central scholarships hit home to me. That was what I thought I heard you say. And did you say there was $500,000 surplus that students did not take because they did not come to WKU?
They either did not accept our scholarship award or they chose not to return. It's a combination of both. of which when you build a $24 million scholarship budget, you're trying to project both.
I understand that.
We allow students to stack up to the total cost of attendance.
Right.
Sometimes a student will get a scholarship offer that they won't receive because their accumulation of other scholarships takes them above the total cost of attendance.
So we've tried to figure out in some of the departments, and I think counseling's going to make a presentation later, and that in administration and recruiting say that sometimes students leave because of a very small number. $500. Is this correct, Sharon? $1,000. If we've got a pocket of money that's been budgeted that we're setting on $500,000, at some point that money should be allocated to the folks that are in the position to be able to say, we need $1,000 to keep this student enrolled. That, if that money is there and we're now discovering it to fill a gap, how long have that been going on? Because that would fund the differential that these students need to be able to stay in school.
Let me put that in context. This wasn't something we discovered because it was only year before last that we were
in a deficit.
Extensive overspending in our scholarship budget, and we reworked our scholarship procedure to put us in a position to have this very outcome. We reworked our scholarship budget.
I understand, but it's a two...
We have done
what we intended to do.
I got that.
The number was larger. This is a combination of, we first went back and made some one-time awards based on, you know, we wanted to look at students that had, you know, you're not going to help pay their tuition bill if they have a 2.2. You know, this program is designed for merit awards, not need-based. But we did go back. I don't remember what the balance was, but over the course of evaluating students' loan packages and the gap between how much they still owed, yes, we have used surplus, one-time surplus. These are one-time awards to some of the students, leaving us an estimated $500,000. Now, your point is we could have used it all up, and student financial aid would probably have been thrilled if we had, but I asked them to probably stop at $500,000 so we could, because of all the other complexities of using carry forward.
I'm just trying to put a positive spin on money that's sitting there if we're trying to keep and retain students.
They have done that with some one-time awards. Now, there are a lot of areas of the university budget that aren't funded the way they probably ought to be funded. One of the ones that is not funded adequately is called returning students. We've got students that, what if they didn't even come here their freshman year? The freshman year is where you get that presidential award. You know, they may be a really good student and they come in in their sophomore year, junior year to WKU, and they've missed that window of opportunity, but they're a good student. You'll see a lot of that going on within the Office of Student Financial Assistance. Yes, we try to do some need-based awards if there's academic merit. And you're correct, we probably could have allocated the entire $500,000.
But once again, the positive spin on this is that if you've got someone that leaves in the end of their freshman year from a minor problem, you've lost their senior year tuition. And
yes.
So if you're really looking at retention, and we're sitting on $500,000, that could have been implemented even this year to ensure that our revenue stream in the future could have been better. And that it's not a negative, it's the positive side that I'm trying to focus on.
Sort of adding to it, okay? I kind of think it's probably, it's almost like inviting 20 people to dinner and having enough food for 20 people. And you've got a lot more waiting to get in. And you hope that the first 20 don't eat at all. Okay.
That's not bad. I like it.
But the fact is, we know we've got a lot more students needing money than we have money to give. But the problem on this $500,000 or a good bit of it is that you don't even really know you're going to have it until it's probably too late to have given it to a student that we might have saved and needed it, because you don't know. You didn't have it at the beginning, and the fact that it comes online after the fact. So the positive spin, I guess, is, and there is one, is that I'm very pleased to see us managing the scholarship money in a way that we're not deficit. And I guess the difficult part of it is it's just really hard to know who's going to leave and how much they're going to leave behind. But at least we came out positive. We need more to dinner.
One last comment on this. I don't want anyone to think this is the... I want to again point out, we're bored. The committee meeting is the time to have these discussions.
Yes, sir. Agreed.
And so I'm hoping that my dialogue today will also stimulate other board members to start, you know, to participate in their feelings and how they would like to see things done, because that is shared governance. We can't wait till we get to the full board meeting and just everybody just say, okay, here it is. So these comments, I'm hoping, will help us all to have a dialogue about these issues, because they're quite serious.
One important, you're right, John, and thank you. An important variable for this board to sustain or continue to be mindful of is if we'd have had a $6.5 million shortfall to balance a budget by year end, and we're talking about it in March. If that would have happened 10 or 15, especially 20 years ago, when our budget was $150 million, $200 million, or $250 million, this could have been. We would not have had solutions.
Mm-hmm.
With a budget that's now well north of $400 million, that capacity, when we grew from 14,500 to now 20,000, but as high as 21,000 students, that capacity gave us considerable strength to address matters just like this. And so that's why we have between $20 and $30 million of carry forward in any given year across our divisions. That gives us capacity to have a balanced budget. Now, we're claiming some of that. And when you hear our budget presentation in a few weeks, in April, you'll be briefed on how we're changing the carry-forward policy to first balance the budget, and then whatever's left will be redistributed proportionally across the divisions. We've learned that this year, and we're applying it to balance this year's budget. And yes, it's a little bit unfortunate for some who may have spent most of their carry forward already this year, and others who haven't, who listened back in October when we said, don't spend it. So there may be some unfairness in how this year's budget is being settled, but next year it'll be completely equitable in how the carry forward is used to balance next year's budget, while the next president is given the opportunity to put a budget model in place consistent with whatever strategic plan comes forward in the coming year. So I just want you to understand that as we've grown, capacity is an important variable in addressing matters such as this. And fortunately, we've got capacity to deal with this without having to cut base budgets. Now, at some point, base budgets may need to be addressed, but not to ensure that we have a balanced budget this year. So that's, I just think that's an important perspective from where we operate these days, as opposed to where we may have operated earlier, and certainly in my presidency.
I want to say something on the positive side about what Gary just said, because I've been here 21 years, and John, in regard to that $500,000, when I came, people knew they got to sit at the table and talk about getting a share of money that was left over, carry forward at that time. But I think to some extent, what we have is a system, and not all universities do, we have a system that tries to allocate as much of the revenue we really think we're going to have as possible so you can spend it. There are a lot of campuses that do not do that. There are a lot of campuses that allocate it so conservatively and so safely, at the end of the year, you know you're going to come forward and say, we did great. We not only live within our budget, we've got excess. You've got that excess because you weren't willing to take a chance on allocating it and letting people have an opportunity to use it. So I think that is a compliment to our budgeting process. Now, a lot of things have changed, which leads me to what I think is a visible discussion, and Ann and I have talked about this. I think one of the things that this board needs to know more about, and I'm going to credit Philip, who's always telling us about consequential boards, because it is part of being a consequential board, is to think about what happened inside of this $6.5 million shortfall relative to our population, coming, our programming, but especially our population. What is it that we know about our population changes inside the $6.5 million that's going to affect our planning, our policies, our future direction, and our stability? And I think, John, that's part of what you're saying, too. This is the time to talk about that. And, Anna, exactly. So if I would ask you, can you give us a little light about what happened inside of this? Are we seeing any kind of trends, anything we ought to be thinking about, population changes that are going to affect us down the road?
You know, it's a bit like your broker saying past performance is no guarantee of future performance. We continue to have a decline in part-time students. It's one area that we've tried to address. You've heard anecdotal about the economy improves and they don't choose to continue or pursue a degree. You know, that's one population. We hired an individual to specialize in going after the adult learner. You mentioned at one time the Learn and Earn program, trying to find different strategies to address why they're not choosing to come. But we're not unique in that one population. You've seen the challenges that KCTCS has had in declining enrollment, and KCTCS has always been a private primary avenue for part-time students. So they haven't solved this issue either. So you know, when you look at what happens in that $6.5 million. And why we're there, it's still trying to address the part-time learner, whether it's undergraduate or graduate, is a significant component. And there are some volatility that we knew would be inherent in recruiting in the international market. So that one is, we've got aggressive strategies to identify different populations. But when you see the value, an international student, a non-resident, it's about 2.5 times the amount of tuition you get for a resident. All of us are, all colleges and universities are trying to find out how to be successful in the international market. So why do we need to go after the international market? Well, a fundamental fact is that for years we're flat in the traditional high school graduate numbers. And you have 9 universities and community colleges and technical colleges all going after a larger piece of a kind of a fixed pie. So, you know, we've got strategies in place to address your traditional freshman recruitment. We've got strategies that relate to what we call incentive counties. Especially those that are an easy driving distance of Bowling Green, and then we have unique strategies for various countries internationally. So, and the last variable that you're quite aware of is what can we do to improve our retention outcomes? We keep talking about great strategies, but they have not yielded quite as we had expected yet. So part of the decline occurred in the spring. The decline that occurred in the spring was higher than normal, and we've still got some analytical work to do to find out exactly why that those students didn't return. You know, in our discussion, I want to go back and look at, with the Office of Student Financial Assistance, those students that had one of our merit scholarships last year and didn't return this year. I think we need to know, why didn't you come back? You know, we offered you one of our best scholarships. Why aren't you here? So there's just a lot of analytical work that still needs to be done to be able to understand the decline that occurred this year?
We will. You'll see, and our man is right. This is a spring shortfall to balance the budget by the end of the fiscal year, and losses from fall to spring play a big role in this number. That's not so much a recruitment thing. It's simply a reality. You will see in our next budget that we will propose with projected deficits for next year, there will be some investments in some new positions to address retention. It's important that we do that, and we will gradually move to, not pervasively, but extensively, a professional advisor model in our Office of Undergraduate Advisor working with the colleges. So a lot of strategies are in play, but I would, to further respond to Barbara's question, I would like to defer some of that until Brian Meredith makes the enrollment report. We have the final census numbers as of this week, and this week was the final census date. So we'll go through the enrollment report in every sector, every category, and you can see the ups and downs and how all that relates to this number. But again, I go back to, I want to caution everyone that this is not a crisis. This is a serious matter, but this is not a overly dramatic circumstance. We have the capacity to address this, and we will have the capacity to address it next year while a new budget model and a new strategic plan is being created. And I think that's the important thing for the board to understand. No positions are being cut. No base budgets are being cut. We're going to balance this budget. It's got the base funding. Now, they're going to do away with some things that they maybe had planned on doing, as Ann went through some of the things on the list, and that's a little bit painful. But we're not going through a budget cut right now of base budgets. We can balance this budget, and we will balance this budget, and we will have a balanced budget for you in April for next year.
I assume there are some position reductions in there, though. I mean,
no.
We're not filling positions, at least.
No.
Well, there may be some that had carry forward money because of some vacant positions, and we may be capturing some of that, so they may have a hard time filling some positions, but that's rare. You can probably count on maybe two hands the amount of that. The police department, for example, has four or five vacancies, and they're going to lose some of their carry forward, so they may not be able to fill all of those vacancies in the coming months, but they'll be able to fill most of them. Brian, is that a fair?
Yes.
So, I would not say no, but I would not say it's significant. I would say it is not significant.
Mr. Chair, I'll call a question.
Okay. Any further comments, or all in favor of FB action item number 5, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All from any members opposed? Hearing no opposition, the motion carries unanimously. So that covers our action items, and Mr. is up next on the quarterly internal audit report.
You need to stand up and do some jumping jacks? I feel like I might need to. Okay. Well, good morning. Here's my thing here. First thing I want to do is call attention to a correction that needs to be made, and that is on your information item. There are two things listed on there that are under completed projects, and that is incorrect. One of those is still in management review, and that's the bad debt expense audit for third-party receivables. So we are going to table that for the next meeting. So that's still in review, so we didn't want to get into that today. So with that, that leaves us with the data center physical environment audit. Our scope for that audit, it included security practices, access management, and just the overall physical environment of the university's data centers. And our key objectives for that were to gain an understanding of best practices for data centers and to compare what our data centers are doing or what they look like to those best practices, and then document the physical security and access controls to related to those data centers. And the results for that audit included four recommendations, which were all accepted by management. And typically, I discuss the high-priority recommendations. And for this particular audit, we had three mediums and one low. And on the flip side of those recommendations, I think I mentioned at the last committee meeting that in our reports we have a section called Good Practices Identified, where we try to give the client credit for the things that they are doing well. And for this project, they had eight good practices that we could identify at the time. And overall, this project, it was just a good opportunity for us to get in with the IT staff and work with them and gain some knowledge in that area. And I have to say that the staff was very patient and very helpful, considering we are not IT auditors, myself and the other auditor, Ms. Sarah Reese. We know that we are not IT auditors, and the IT staff knows that we are not IT auditors. So I would say, Gordon Johnson, thank you to you and your staff for being so patient with us throughout this project. And that's a fairly quick version of that. Because this is one of the completed projects, so what's the rest of the audit calendar look like? This is what it looks like. It looks pretty full. But the top three projects listed on here are in some stage of the audit process right now. Like I mentioned, the bad debt expense, third-party receivables, that is currently in review, and it should be issued fairly quickly. And the other next thing on the list is the bad debt expense related to student receivables. If you went back and looked at the audit plan, the bad debt expense was listed as one project. And after we did our pre-planning conference with the key personnel, we decided it would be better to actually separate those two things out and have two different reports to make it more manageable, because the differences between the types of receivables and the differences between the actual bad debt calculation. So that's why you see it as two different things here, and you'll see two different reports coming your way also. So the rest of the things that are listed there, note the last three, those are the things that we call continuous auditing, and we try to touch on those throughout the year, and then we'll provide that one annual report at the end of the year to talk about what we've covered and what we've seen for those things as well. So those are some of the things that you can kind of look forward to for the June committee meeting. And not only that, but there's some other information that we'll talk about next time. If you remember, we have the annual risk assessment that comes up every time this year. And that's done in conjunction with Administrative Council. But also, as a reminder, the Finance and Budget Committee members are surveyed as well for risk assessment, and that's a directive in our internal audit charter. So you'll be receiving some information on that in probably the next few weeks or so. Also, another thing that we continue to do is research and prepare for a future quality assessment review. I know I've mentioned that particular thing, also called a QAR, and I've talked about it just briefly in other committee meetings, but I wanted to give you a little more information about that as we continue to learn more about how that's supposed to work. So there's three objectives with that assessment, and it's basically, the first one would be to determine whether or not the internal audit function is in general compliance with the international standards for the professional practice of internal auditing. That's a mouthful. So we try to adhere to those standards, which are publicized by the Institute of Internal Auditors. So that's one objective of the QAR. The second one is to determine whether the function is meeting management's needs. Yay. And having the QAR also meets the requirements for one of the international standards that I mentioned, and that is standard number 1312. And that states basically that every 5 years you have an external review of your audit function, and they basically audit the auditors. That's what that's doing. So we hope to have that. You see the target date completion either before or by April of 2019. Also, the last thing that I'll mention, we continue to work on hotline reports. Currently, there are two active ones that we are reviewing. And we advertise the hotline every time we issue a newsletter, there's always an article in there to reach out to the campus community to make sure that they are aware. We haven't had a lot of activity, and that's good and bad, if you want to look at it both ways. So we're trying to figure out what we need to do to make sure that people are aware that that's available. And one thing I'll mention, the staff council just recently did a staff survey, and one of the questions was, do you know that there is an ethics and compliance hotline available? And I'm waiting to get that data so I can know if there's a disconnect between that and the staff knowing that that is available. I do believe that the faculty are aware, only because we've had to entertain some questions from the Faculty Senate regarding the hotline, and because of those questions, we actually revamped our internal audit web pages to make sure that that was available and you could see it when you go out there to look at internal audit, and it's easy to find.
What level of risk are you seeing from the active reports?
I'm sorry?
What level of risk do you see from the hotline?
Some of it's policy compliance. Some of it's possibly misappropriation of time usage. I'm trying to think of a couple of examples. They have different categories that they put them in, and I can get you a report for that if you'd like. So the last thing to wrap up just would be to remember that be on the lookout for the risk assessment piece, and you'll be getting an email just to make sure that you're aware, and then the actual survey comes later. And when you get that, if you have any questions, to contact me if you need any assistance with that or want to talk in general over the phone about that. So that is all, unless you have questions.
I do. Can we go back to the data? No, shake it. Here, I just want to show my ignorance. On your risk evaluation, on item number one relating to the relocation of the center, you seem to be saying that is a concern, that a natural disaster could occur and knock everything out.
Right.
And you assign that a medium risk.
We do that on a.
Why did you assign that category?
We do that on a scale based on likelihood and impact. Impact would be high if it happened, but the likelihood is fairly low that that's going to happen based on where we are and what type of disasters could happen. And that was a lengthy discussion that we had with their staff, and to make sure that we were aware of the other things that they have in place of that with other business continuity efforts. So it's kind of on a scale of use the same similar scale as we would for enterprise-wide management, a little smaller, but it's basically likelihood and impact that we would look at to do those ratings.
Okay, and then my next question, though, is the administration response to that was they may investigate relocating as opposed will or...
Well, I think they will, and Gordon Johnson can speak to that.
I don't put you on the spot, but it said may, so I wanted to...
The data center location issue is something that we look at every single year. It's something we're very aware of. And it's not an ideal situation. It's also not totally unusual at universities. It's basically a cost issue. Mm-hmm. We want to move that data center to a co-located facility. We're going to pay 10 times what it costs us right now to keep it where it is. And I'm talking $100,000 a year versus $1 million. Because we have a very robust duplication of our production data center up in the other facility. So it's everything from systems to bandwidth to hardware costs to basically moving that off-site is a very expensive proposition versus the risk that we sort of have to weigh against what's the likelihood that some event's going to come through here and physically incapacitate this building and that building. So, I mean, it's not something that we don't ever worry about. It is definitely a worry. It's just sort of a matter of how much money do you want to spend to get rid of that particular work. So, again, we look at this every year. We have a business continuity disaster recovery plan. We do those annually. It's always on the top of the list of something we look at, and we're always looking at cost and other ways to move it or move pieces of it that make financial sense. Excuse me. suffering from a little accident I have. I don't know how gently worded that we may look at it. We look at this every year.
Okay.
And, you know, the options for moving something like that, everything from moving it to the Amazon cloud, to co-locating it at another university, to co-locating it at someplace like Rackspace. And we know all those options and what they cost, and we look at them every year. So as soon as we get some sort, and these have come down, by the way. I mean, this used to be more of a $2 million problem than a $1 million problem. They come down every year because cloud providers and the ability and bandwidth capacities and the cost of bandwidth have come down over time to some degree. But when you start talking about taking the amount of data, which is in the hundreds of thousands of terabytes, and trying to move them and replicate them regularly to a co-location facility, you're talking big bucks. So, again, I'm not going to get that. I mean, I'm willing to talk about that with any other board members. If anybody wants to discuss that further, it's something that I'm, you know, never totally comfortable with the way we have this set up. But if we do have a very robust backup facility that we can literally turn on any of our mission critical systems if we had an incapacitation of this particular building, and that's more likely. It's more likely we have a fire here, this building gets taken out, that one's still there. What would take both buildings out? An earthquake, an F6 tornado that doesn't exist, but let's say it was in the hot. I want to discuss it more with anybody who's interested.
Yeah. And the only other question I have is in two sections of your report, you make a comment about access to the main data center and, I think, admission of software companies. Is that a concern?
That's not physical access. Go ahead. Sorry. Okay. I'm so sorry.
It's her fault, Gordon, for making me think this way.
About that the other day. The way that number three reads, it sounds like we let third-party vendors actually physically come into the data center.
Uh-huh.
That's not what happened.
Okay.
We have some third-party systems that are running inside our data center but are maintained by third-party vendors, and we give them remote access into one and one server only.
Okay.
So it's not a physical access situation, and it's really – I was a little worried about the way that was worded. So,
okay. And your worry came to fruition here, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Because I'm glad you caught that. It's interesting. It means you're reading this stuff. By the
way, you think I get to sleep at night?
We do read this stuff.
I'm glad. But along those lines, I just want to say, Jennifer over there is sly like a fox. She says, I'm not an IT auditor. Let me tell you, Jennifer and Sarah Reese come in. When they do something in IT, it's as good or better than any other external auditor that does anything. And they don't leave any rocks unturned. We pretty much have to be on our toes when she walks in the door. So that's part of the thing. She comes in and looks all innocent.
Me? What?
Thank you, Gordon. No more questions. Anybody else want to chime in?
Okay, thank you.
Well. I believe the gentleman's time has expired.
That wraps up finance and budget. We probably need a break. Everybody agree? Short break. Let's try to hold it to five. This is 10. Let's try to hold it. You'll be with us all day.
1.8 hours.
Short break.